Thanks for joining us and welcome to the Stonebridge Church Podcast. Here at Stonebridge, our goal is to lead people into a real, healthy, and growing relationship with Jesus Christ. If you'd like to join us live, we hold services every Sunday at 9:30 and 11:05 a.m. at 1 Stonebridge Church Drive in the Woodlands, Texas. You can also stream our services online on Facebook, our website, our YouTube channel, and our church app. We invite you to check out our website at GoStonebridge.com and give us a like on Facebook at Facebook.com/GoStonebridge. This week, Pastor Steve continues our series, Dream Small. Now, here's Pastor Steve.
All right, good morning. We've been talking about dreaming small and about being a parent, raising kids, all the things that you go through, and you learn as you go through them. And I have to, let me tell you, a lot of people, this is the kind of message series, something like this, that a lot of people avoid. In fact, I even have friends that, and one friend that said, God would never want you to preach on anything like this. I'm serious. He really did. And it's because it absolutely terrified him to even think of something like this. So just to let you know, if I seem a little too comfortable doing this, I like this. I do, because it's how we live. It's what we go through in life. And so part of my theology, my understanding of who God is that God walks with us through what? Yeah, just what you go through, what you live through. In fact, that doesn't threaten God at all. It may threaten us sometimes. It may threaten the way we see things, but it doesn't threaten God. But life can be difficult. Life can be confusing. And this morning I want to talk about, if you looked in your outline, flying the coop, right? Because at some point your kids are going to leave, or I know some people are saying, are you serious? When? Because, you're having a hard time getting them to leave, and it probably fits the logo better than anything else, this idea of, man, they're going to head out one day. So here's the struggle with it. In fact, I'll go ahead and tell you. My daughter doesn't like me bringing this up because she has a four-year-old. And so I will do things, probably shouldn't, but I'll do really bad things, like calculate how many years she has left or what percentage of time she has left. She says, Dad, because it adds a little panic and a little fear into her life, and at the same time, some sadness. Anybody feel sadness lately that your kids are flying the coop or leaving? How many people you've kind of gone through that? Come on, honestly, I know a lot of you are lying. Come on, but yeah, of course you do. Because the one thing that's hard to grasp is the fact that you're not raising kids. You're not raising children. You are raising what? Young adults to fly the coop. That's what you're doing. We have ducks on the pond. I've told you that before, where we live. And so they'll have a little duckling. And so we're always pulling for them that they survive. And so it's always at that time that my wife gets very defensive about other animals. You know, anything that looks like it might eat a baby duck, so she goes into the mom protective mode because she wants to see those ducks grow up, those little ducklings grow up. Here's the problem, though. If they grow up, what are they going to do? They're still going to be gone. They're still going to leave because they're going to fly off. They're not going to stay there either way. So I keep telling them, if we have duck for dinner, they're going to leave anyway. I mean, I'm just kidding. I know. It's just, but they're going to leave. They're going to fly the coop. They're going to go. And it's in all of us. In fact, if you want to fill in the blanks, here's what the first one is in your outline. It is that everyone struggles with this desire for freedom and independence. Of course we do. Everyone struggles with this. Even when your kids are born, they are 100% dependent, but it does not take them long, right? It does not take long at all before they start trying to exercise some freedom and independence, some control over situations. And listen, some of us need to be honest. You might have a four-year-old and they're totally in control already anyway. You've lost control already. And it's a difficult thing to go through for both kids and for adults, for parents, because they're moving toward flying the coop. I still love it in, I think it's in the Latin. Didn't go back and look it up. I need to do that at times. I think it's in the Latin that the word adolescence, if you break it down in the Latin, it means two people in the same body. So in other words, adolescence, your children, a modern definition would be schizophrenia. That's what it is. And you might think, well, that explains everything. Of course it does. It actually does. Because you've got a child who is dependent and needs to be taken care of, cannot take care of themselves. Remember when you decided you got mad at your parents and you packed up your backpack and threw some food in there, the good stuff, Oreos and you left home only to return later because you were hungry and you realize you can't take care of yourself. Sure, that's exactly what children do because they can't. And here's the thing. You were once that way also. I know your kids don't believe it. My kids, for the longest time, absolutely did not believe that Joni and I were ever, anything but what they saw. Boring adults, right? Who were square and who were always telling them no and wouldn't let them go do everything that they wanted to do. But it's true. But also in that same body is this independent, pushing for freedom, little girl or little boy trying to move forward and trying to break out and frustrated that they can't move forward and that they can't break out any faster than they do. When you were a kid, I know you probably don't remember it if it's been a long time since you were a kid, but you dreamed of the day that you would be mommy or daddy, that you would be the adult. Because then when you became the adult, what was going to happen? Then you can do anything you want to do. Then you became an adult, right? And you learned that's not true. Then you had kids. And you realize, no, that's even less true than it was before. Man, this is more binding and more restrictive than it ever was when I was a kid. That's why most kids dream of becoming adults, and most adults dream of being what? Yeah. If I could just go back to then, that point in time. Of course. It's because this is the way we struggle. And if you look in the Bible from the Old Testament all the way to the New Testament, you will see constant stories and constant pictures of this struggle that we go through because this is part of how God has wired us and how God has made us and what He's taking us through. And it's never, ever as simple as we'd like it to be because there are two people kind of warring in the same body. In the New Testament, one of my favorite stories, you should know it well also, is the story of the prodigal son. What does the prodigal son want? He wants to be independent. He wants to be free. He just wants all the resources, or at least his cut of the resources that his father has. So he says, I want the money, and then I'll go off and I can live any way that I want to. It shows the foolishness of the other side of us, and that is this rebellion side of us that doesn't take some things into account. When he leaves, he loses certain things. One we talked about 2 weeks ago. He loses his identity. Because what he's saying is, I just want to be me. I want to live my life. I want to cut my own trail. I want to be what I dream of being or what I want to be. I don't want to be held back and tied to who my mom and my dad were, who my family. I don't want any of that. And he goes away, leaving that behind, only to find out he lost everything. He does the second thing. We talked about this one last week. He actually loses contentment and satisfaction. What's really going to make him happy? Because what he thinks is, I've got all the money, I can go and I'll be popular, everybody will love me, I'll be partying all the time. He does until what runs out? The resources. And then he finds out, I don't have anything. There's nothing that's going to satisfy me. Nothing lasts that I was chasing after. And in both of these, the only way he finds what he's been looking for is he has to go back where? Yeah, he has to go back home. And he goes back home realizing, I've wasted it. I've blown it. What was I thinking? Listen, let me go and tell you something. We all go through that. The prodigal son is a story for all of us. We all go through that to some extent. Because we're having to learn how it works and how it doesn't work. And it really is all tied into this third thing also, and that is about our freedom and our independence. My thrill was going off to college. Because even though I thought I was independent, of course, my dad was paying for my college. And, it was like $3,000 or $4,000 a year to, I'm sorry, I know, but... That included room and board. So I went off to college. They were still paying for it. And of course, I love the idea. Now I can do whatever I want to do. And of course, I found out quickly, or I didn't find out, thank goodness, you know, a couple of my friends found out they could do anything they wanted to do until the semester ended and they failed and mom and dad said, we're not paying anymore, and they had to come back home. And now they found themselves right back where they were before. And they weren't nearly as independent as they thought they were or as free as they thought they were, right? And you've probably done the same thing. You've wanted freedom. I want to do whatever I want to do, only to find out that a lot of the things that you want to do and you go do don't turn out very well. And if you just do what you want to do, you probably are going to mess up your life and make it a whole lot worse instead of a whole lot better. And then you find out that back in this relationship and back in this place of some sort of dependence is where you really actually found the freedom to be and to become who you were supposed to be. From your identity to your satisfaction to even true freedom and independence. Listen, this is the story of Genesis. I know there are, and every time somebody told me, says, every time we talk about anything, you go back to Genesis. Well, you can, because it's such a wonderful example and a wonderful picture of what we go through. That's actually why it's there, to show us, you know, where all this comes from. And Adam and Eve, you know, at some point are tempted and are talked into the idea, if you can just break free from your old identity with God, if you can just break free from the idea that you have to be there in the garden with God for your satisfaction, if you can just break free from this idea of these restrictions and these laws and these rules, because after all, there's one whole tree you can't eat from, you know? So, you know, you've got to break free from that, become free in yourself, and then you'll find freedom. And what they found was they lost everything. Everything that made them happy, everything that gave them identity, everything that satisfied them, everything that actually set them free was actually in the garden. Because that's where their protector was. That's where the one who created them was. That's where the bigger part of actually who they were actually lived. And that was the part that they lost. So I want to take you to a story in the Old Testament again. And I've been kind of working through Moses and his identity and his satisfaction. And of course, you know that Moses, you know, at 40 years old, Moses realizes he was an Egyptian. Instead, he's Hebrew. Moses, you know, goes off into the wilderness to really find himself. And that's really where he does for 40 years. And he comes back, you know, 40 years later, he's 80 years old. And he's only back because, not because he's full of himself and he thinks I can tackle anything, only because, you know, God says that's where you're going to go back to. And he comes back to Egypt. And if you remember the story, he goes to the Pharaoh and he says, let my people go. And of course the Pharaoh says, hey, I remember you. You have no power nor control. He says, okay, well, this is the way it is. If you don't let God's people go, and he kept referring to, they're going to go for 3 days just to go out and worship God toward the wilderness, out into the Sinai, the desert. If you don't let them go, you know, then you're going to have to pay the price. You're going to have to deal with God. He said, not going to do it. Then God would strike him with a what? They called them what? The 10 plagues of Egypt. And I always love how and I love history, so I watch a lot of history shows that try to explain, well, here's what could have happened, which is always amazing to me, because all they do is make it more difficult to understand. You know, when they try to piece them all together and say, this is just a natural occurrence, there's nothing natural about this. And Pharaoh realizes, what am I doing? Let the people go, only to harden his heart and say, nope, not going to let them go. And so Moses comes back and says, okay, well, the second plague is going to be worse than the first, and the third plague is going to be worse and the second, and he just keeps going down the line. He goes through these 10 plagues, and they get to finally the 10th plague, right? And the 10th plague is what? Do you remember what it was? If you don't let my people go, I'm going to send the angel of death, and the angel of death is going to take the life of every firstborn in Egypt. Every firstborn in Egypt. And there's only one way around this. And that is, they were to go and they were to sacrifice a lamb and paint the doorpost of their house with the blood of the lamb. They had to do this, to signify, kind of strange, you know, but they're painting blood on the doorposts of their house, and every house that is painted this way, every Hebrew house, if an Egyptian house were to do it, but those who believe and had faith did this, the angel of death will what? Pass over that house. That's where we get the name. That's where Passover comes from. And it is so devastating to Egypt. And it is so devastating, as if the other plagues weren't, to Pharaoh himself, who loses his firstborn son, that he says, let them go. And so they do. They let them go. And now here's what happens. As they leave, if I can only paint a picture, because we don't know the exact route that they took, but we know that they worked and they lived in a city of Ramses, and they built things, and they go, and there's a part of the peninsula that comes up, the where the canal now is, that divides the land. So they had to cross over that somehow. And so they're up north and they're going to the land of Canaan. So it was natural for them to go that direction. And as they get there and as they're journeying, Pharaoh all of a sudden realizes, what have we done? What in the world have we done? Because, you know, 3 days later, which is kind of the time frame he probably would have been thinking, they're going to be gone for 3 days. They're not coming back. And he's had to deal with, you know, the tragedy in Egypt, and he's angry. And so this is what it says. This part's not in the passage. You can look in the first part of the chapter, because I couldn't fit it all in the outline. But it says this, that God tells them as they're traveling, they're actually going a little southeast. He says, go back. Now they're going around a body of water. He says, go back. And he says, Pharaoh will think that you're stupid and you're confused and all, but go back. And they do this really strange thing. Go back to where they would actually be trapped by this giant lake. It's called, you know, they would call it the Red Sea, or actually in the Hebrew, it's the Sea of Reeds or the Sea of Papyrus, and go there where now it would look like They've wandered into a blind alley. They can't go anywhere, and Pharaoh will have them trapped. And here's how the story reads. This is in the Exodus chapter 14, and it says in verse number 5, when word reached the king of Egypt that the Israelites had fled, so he kind of figures it out days and days later, Pharaoh and his officials did what? Now, let me tell you what's going to happen, because this was always the pattern. I call this the 11th plague. Because that's actually what it is. Same pattern. Pharaoh changes his mind and he thinks, nope, I'm the one in control. I can do what I want to do. I am, same thing, I'm the master of my own destiny as well as of all of Egypt. And those Israelites, those slaves, are certainly not going to, you know, boss me around. And they're certainly not going to leave, because we would lose this free labor. So he changes his mind. What have we done? Letting all those Israelites slaves get away, they ask. So Pharaoh harnessed his chariot and called up his troops. He took with him 600 of Egypt's best chariots, that's his select group, along with the rest of the chariots of Egypt, each with its commander. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. So he chased after the people of Israel, who had left with fist raised in defiance. I like this. In fact, this is a New Living Translation, isn't it? Yeah. And I usually, when I want to get real literal, go to the New American Standard. But here's the one place that the New American Standard, in trying to help you understand it, actually doesn't give as fragrant a translation. It would just, New American Standard would just say that, and they left with boldness. But it, literally in the Hebrew, it says this, they left with hands held high. Now, a lot of people would say, yeah, they left like this, praising God. That's not it. This is the translation. This is the understanding. They left with, yeah, baby, we're out of here. We are leaving Egypt and no one can take us on. And I mean, they are pumped up. They are fired up in sort of in Pharaoh and Egypt's face. 10 plagues, devastating plagues to the mighty empire of Egypt. And they are walking out like this, which really, really, really burns Pharaoh, right? If you're an Aggie and you watch that game, really burns you when Clemson tied, you know, right? I mean, of course it does. We're all like that. There's something inside of us that says, no way I'm letting them get away with that. We've all experienced it from both sides. This is how Egypt is walking out. I look at it when I see this as saying, it's like a bunch of kids. I mean, hadn't grown up, hadn't realized, you know, I don't know that I'd be quite, you know, going out that way, because it's not like life will be like this forever. Doesn't work that way. You want to be a little bit more humble, you know, in your approach. They go out with fist held high. And then this is what it says in verse number 9. The Egyptians chased after them with all the forces of Pharaoh's army. all his horses and his chariots, his charioteers, all his troops. The Egyptians caught up with the people of Israel as they were camped beside the shore of, and I'm not going to try to pronounce these, across from, I'm not going to pronounce that one also. And this is where they were, trapped by the sea. And all of a sudden, you know, the fists held high. There's the armies, the chariots, the warriors of Egypt. Israel was a lot of things. Israel was a huge number of people. Israel was, at this time, they were really good at, you know, making bricks and building cities and probably shepherding, because they would have had their flocks with them, and probably some sort of farming, because they would grow wheat and grain, and they would cut and use the hay in their bricks. They were good at certain things. They were not fighters. They were not warriors. They were not trained, heavy infantry, trained with chariots, trained with bows, spears, probably slings, projectiles like bullets being thrown from the slingers, what they call them. This is not what they did for a living. This is what they had no experience at all to. And now, all of a sudden, they're faced with an army right behind them, and they are trapped by the sea. It says as verse number 10, as Pharaoh approached the people of Israel, they looked up and panic as they saw the Egyptians overtaking them. They cried out to the Lord, and they said to Moses, now, does this sound like a kid? Does this sound like being a child, right? Here we go. Why did you bring us here to die in the wilderness? Now, we were just doing this, right? Yeah. And now it's absolutely turned in their panic. Why did you bring us here to die in the wilderness? Weren't there enough graves for us in Egypt? What have you done to us? Why did you make us leave Egypt? Here's even more. Listen to this. Didn't we tell you this would happen when we were still in Egypt? Yeah, when we were doing this, right? Didn't we tell you it was going to turn out like this? We said, leave us alone. Let us be slaves to the Egyptians. It is better to be a slave in Egypt than to be a corpse in the wilderness. Now, if you go back and you read, that's not at all what they were saying. They're like, God, where are you? Do you not see that we are oppressed by the Egyptians? Do you not care for this? You call us your people. How can you leave us like this? And they cried over and over. But all of a sudden now, faced with the armies of Egypt against them, they panic and they totally flip. They totally flip. Listen, this is real life. This is how we do things so many times. This is how your kids do things sometimes, or will do things. You know, I want to be out on my own. I want to be independent. Okay, you go find your own way. Well, wait a minute. Who's going to pay my bills? You know, who's going to tell me how to do that? Sure, because that's what we all go through. We all struggle with these things. And every parent struggles with, if they were to let their kids become free, and as their kids do go out in independence, you know what you'd struggle with? Are they going to make it? Are they going to survive? I still remember Joni and I, we would have these discussions, and as Jamie went off to school, she goes off to a military academy, and if you were ever to go to her room, every day it looked like a tornado had hit it, every day. And my wife, you know, would pick it all up and put it all back, and then the next day a tornado hit it, and she's like, they're not going to do that at one of these places, right? Because they inspect your room every morning, everything has to be absolutely perfect, or you get punish, because punishment works in those situations. And I would tell her all the time, she'll figure it out. Right? My son, we were always worried with my son, is he going to pass the next grade? I mean, I'm serious, you know, because he worked on the subjects he liked, the others he ignored, and we were constantly having to work with him to get those things done. He had a condition called dysgraphia, so it's the ability to put words on paper, and yet he loved language. You know, he was really good talking and with words and things like that. I'm kind of like that too, but you know, spelling, grammar, you know, this boring stuff. And, you know, so he goes off to college, and Joni's like, go off to college? We weren't sure each semester if he was going to pass, you know, grammar school or junior high or high school. He's going to go off to college. He graduates in 3.5 years with 2 degrees. You know, they figure it out because you build into them. You try to put as much into them as you can. You try to raise them up, and there are certain things they're not going to learn until they have to, and they're on their own. And then they grasp it. They figure. Here's the crazy thing. One of the degrees is in English. What in the world are we talking about? You know, how does he get that? Well, because it actually, you know, it's just one aspect of he didn't do well. He loves language and he loves words and he loves communication and did well with it. Yeah, we panic. Some of our kids, you know, they make their way. They find their way. And as they find their way and they think they're independent, they as they grow up later, they realize, you know what, it wasn't that bad back at home. I know that's going to be, you're going to fall over dead when they come back and say that to you. You know, you're going to be in total shock. But they realize and they come back. If you hang with them and you don't give up and you don't quit and you try to, you know, move to the next stage with your kids, what happens is later on the relationship is different, but the relationship becomes wonderful because they become young adults and later on young parents, and you get a chance to move to the next stage of life, which is great, grand, omnipotent grandfather and things like that. I've changed my title, so just to let you know that, right? Yeah, that's what you get a chance to move to. That's how it works. But you don't quit and you don't give up because they haven't faced everything that they need to face yet to recognize and to understand how life really works. And you get a chance, even those later stages, help them grow, help them learn. Now, you can't treat them like they were, you know, five-year-olds again because they're not, but you still get a chance to be a part of their lives, wonderful part of their lives. That's this picture. Israel's got to grow up. They've got to figure some things out. They've got to find out who God really is. And as Moses is trying to parent them in some ways, God really is the one who parents them and leads them. And so it says down in verse 13, but Moses told the people, listen to this, right? This is what you tell your kids. Don't be afraid. I understand. I know the panic. I remember leaving home and thinking, I don't know if I'm going to survive. I don't know if I can do this. What if I fail? What if I just leave home and I'm never heard from again? You're right. You know, there's that fear. And I knew my parents felt it. I understood because they were like, you know, I wasn't a parent. And I knew they did not want me to leave. Just to let you know, this is one of my rules. I love coming up with the rules like that. So my wife knows it. When our kids left to go off to school or even now when they leave, we never stand at the end of the driveway and wave. Just want to let you know, we don't do it. Somebody say, well, y'all are, you know, but let me tell you why. Because when I remember going off and leaving for the first time to college, and then later when I moved from South Carolina to Texas, and I knew my parents thought he'll probably never move back, and I haven't, you know, I've been here ever since then, but they would stand at the end of the driveway and go, and I'd leave college and they were like, and I felt awful. I'm deserting them, right? They're so sad. And it was terrible. And then, you know, when I'd come back, you know, 3 months later from college at the end of a semester or something, they'd be on the driveway still wearing the same clothes. I'm saying, you know, right? Because that's what you do as parents later on. You know, you're just not as concerned about those things. And you feel terrible about it. You know, like, am I, you know, no. And so I have a rule that I have to tell you when my daughter, because she was going to school in Maryland, so she didn't really drive off. I take her to the airport, and she still knows this because she found out later. So, you know, I had to drop at the airport, and she goes through and all, too. So I, you know, hug her and all, then she'd go off with her big duffel and everything else, too, that she had to carry. It was bigger than she was. And so I got pretty familiar with the airport anyway. So I found out how to go upstairs into some rooms where there were windows, and I could look down through the, you know, when you go through security, and I could watch her going through security. And so I was doing the same thing going, you know. Even though she couldn't see me because I wasn't going to do that to her, but I was still doing the same thing, watching every step. And I would watch her until she got through and she went, and I couldn't see her anymore. And then I'd go out, get in the car, stop by the by the runways, looking which plane, you know, looking for the plane. Yeah. Went to her school the very first time we were there, and we had to leave the very first time. I got up at 4 in the morning. Walked out of the hotel to walk down, because where she went to school, there are walls and gates with people with guns and things like that. And so I'm in a neighborhood on a hill looking into the academy. And my wife says, you know, because I see her about 8 o'clock, what were you thinking? And I said, I don't know. I thought maybe I would see her, you know, maybe I could throw a rope over the wall, you know, she could escape, come back with us, you know, I don't know, right? All these things that come because of the fear, the uncertainty of it. We're not sure. You know, is God going to take us through this? Is he going to? Yeah, yes. And your kids are going to grow up. You might even grow up a little bit, right, through all that. He takes us through it. So Moses looks at him and says, listen, don't be afraid. Look at what he says next. He says, just stand still and watch the Lord rescue you today. Is that a good word? Just stand still and watch the Lord rescue you today. The Egyptians you see today, the enemy, what's coming against you, what you're afraid of, he says, will never be seen again. The Lord himself will fight for you. Just stay calm. Two things real quickly I think that are so important about this passage and understand about what is going here. First of all, they're on the verge of their greatest deliverance, the greatest deliverance of their lives. And yet at the same time, fear and distrust has gripped their heart. And that's what happens to us. We're afraid. We're panicked. What if God doesn't come through? What if God really wasn't watching after us? What if all this talk of Jehovah is just, you know, is false? What if the gods of Egypt, they have a lot of gods and they watch over everything. They've got a god, you know, four or five for everything out there. What if their gods are greater? What am I going to put my hope and my trust in? And this comes over us so that now this fear breeds this distrust in our life. It's a part of a painful doubting and struggle that comes in our life on the eve of their greatest deliverance. It would be their greatest victory of all time. And the second thing is that fear can distort our memories. It can change how we remember God's faithfulness, how God watched after us, how God cared for us, and it can cause you to lose your confidence in God. My dad, I've often told this story, tell again real quickly. My dad, growing up poor, and my dad failed the 10th grade. His dad, he still remembered, his dad told him, you're the dumbest kid I've ever met. My dad carried that with him. And so my dad left home at 16 years old, decided he was going to become rich welding ships in the shipyard because World War II was coming. They were gearing up for it. He almost fell off the side of a ship because somebody tripped over his welding cord, and he realized he could have died, and he realized he was going to die working 7 days a week, about 10 or 12 hours a day before he ever became rich. And so somebody told him, if you enlist in the military because war is coming, it's better than getting drafted. So my dad did, and it was better. They sent him in like 30,000 who enlisted to the mess halls, you know. So like, oh yeah, this is really great. Well, they needed some typists. My dad took typing in high school. Because of that, all of the kids had to take typing in high school, and rather than go to study hall. And so they needed some typists. Bradley comes early in the alphabet. He got pulled in to go into steno pools, that's what they would call them, to type. And then they didn't have anything for him to do. So he took an aptitude test. They found out he wasn't dumb, and they sent him to the School of the South, Swansea, to go to college as we're going into World War II, then to the University of Oklahoma. And then, you know, he was really blessed and got to go to the University of South Carolina, you know, where we grew up. And I'm just messing. And so, you know, and he finished there. And then they didn't have anything to do with him, and they send him to medical school. My dad becomes a doctor. He's moved from the Navy that he enlisted in into the Air Force. And so when the war's over and they get rid of him because they don't need all these guys, he comes out as a captain in the Air Force, and he's an OBGYN. And so my dad would do this. He would always say God was looking after his life way beyond anything he ever looked after his life. Now, here's the funniest thing. We come out of that, and what do as parents? We come in and we try to control everything because we've got to fix it. We've got to fix our kids. We've got to have a future for them. We've got, you know, and this trust, it wars against this trust that my dad, as he would look back, could see, only looking back, he could see God's hand watching after his life and directing his life. And somehow this fear and this anxiety and what we're facing just grips us, and it rips out of us this trust that we should have in God, that God will watch after him, that God has plans, and his plans are always greater than ours. That's where they are. They're like, hi, Moses, how could you lead us here? How could you bring us to this? Right after going, hey, yeah, right? That's where they were. So here's what it picks up in the next verse. It says, then the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Tell the people to get moving. Pick up your staff and raise your hand over the sea. I like that because I think it's a picture of Moses raising his hand, totally different type of raising his hands. He says, divide the water so that the Israelites can walk through the middle of the sea On what? Well, you don't walk through the middle of a sea on dry ground, God. This isn't, you know. And I will harden the heart of the Egyptians, and they will charge in after the Israelites, because they've got them trapped up against this water. My great glory will be displayed through Pharaoh and his troops, his chariots and his charioteers. When my glory is displayed through them, all Egypt will see my glory and know that I am the Lord. Verse 19, then the angel of God who had been leading the people of Israel, some scholars believe this would have been maybe this is a theophany. It's Christ himself as this angel. Don't know for sure. This is how it's worded in the Hebrew. He moved to the rear of the camp. So he goes from leading them to the back of the camp. There's a reason. The pillar of cloud also moved from the front because it was leading them and stood behind them. The cloud settled between the Egyptians and the Israelite camps, and darkness fell. The cloud turned to fire, lighting up the night, but the Egyptians and Israelites did not approach each other all night. So it's this strange thing where this cloud and this pillar of fire somehow is lit, but it's also creating darkness, sucking the light out of there. And so the Egyptians stop. They don't go any closer. It separates them from the Israelites. And then it says in verse 21, then Moses raised his hand over the sea, and the Lord opened up a path through the water with a strong east wind. I still say I'd love to have been there, because this took a tremendous amount of faith from Moses. Go and stretch your hand out of the sea and divide the sea. Well, Moses would think just like you and I can't divide the sea. What are you talking about? This is just by faith. I know, just do what I told you to do. And I'm just telling you, I don't know that I would have done it. I would have said, well, I'm going to really look stupid, God, if I do this and nothing happens. I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to make this happen. I know. Just go and divide the sea by raising your hand, raise your staff up over the water. He does. And it says, the wind blew all that night, turning the seabed into dry land. So the people of Israel walked through. They walked through the middle of the sea on dry land, on dry ground, and with walls of water on each side. Now, this has got to include a tremendous amount of faith for them, because the water would have looked absolutely destructive. It's still, the morning has not come yet. It's still night. There's apparently enough light from this fiery pillar now lighting their way. But this has got to feel weird, right? And this is, you ever been on the freeway and you're going by a semi truck and he's loaded with, you know, I don't know, maybe pipe for an oil well? And there's, you know, there's some straps and bars going up, and you're thinking, what if that breaks? You ever done that? You ever got between two semis and thinking, whoa, Nelly, because I have, and my wife is like, stop, don't drive between them, you know. We need to get out of here. We need to whatever, because what if it doesn't hold? We will be absolutely crushed. That's what they're looking at. And they're supposed to walk through. And I don't think they walk through like this. I think they walk through like this, you know. Oh my goodness. And it's, you know, like I said, it's probably 2.5 million people, their flocks, everything. It's going to take a long time. You sure those are going to hold, you know, that long? Tremendous amount of faith for them to walk through these things. It says, then the Egyptians, in verse 23, all of Pharaoh's horses and chariots and charioteers, they chased them into the middle of the sea. But just before dawn, the Lord looked down on the Egyptian army from the pillar of fire and cloud, and he threw their forces into total confusion. He twisted their chariot wheels, making their chariots difficult to drive. Let's get out of here, away from these Israelites, the Egyptians shouted. The Lord is fighting for them against Egypt. In verse 26, when all the Israelites had reached the other side, the Lord said to Moses, raise your hand over the sea again. Then the waters will rush back over the Egyptians and their chariots and their charioteers. So as the sun began to rise, Moses raised his hand over the sea, and the water rushed back into its usual place. The Egyptians tried to escape, but the Lord swept them into the sea. Then the waters returned and covered all their chariots and charioteers, the entire army of Pharaoh, of all the Egyptians who had chased the Israelites into the sea. Not a single one survived. Verse 29, but the people of Israel had walked through the middle of the sea on dry ground as the water stood up with walls on both sides. This is how the Lord rescued Israel from the hand of the Egyptians that day. And the Israelites saw the bodies of the Egyptians washed up on the seashore. When the people of Israel saw the mighty power that the Lord had unleashed against the Egyptians, they were filled with awe before Him. They put their faith in the Lord and in His servant Moses. Now, I think the picture here is so important and so important for you to understand. This is, in a sense, the essence of the Exodus. And this means their redemption, this Exodus means they were set free from the bondage of the Egyptians. On one side of the sea is bondage and the Egyptians. On the other side of the sea is freedom. It's true freedom. It's a loyalty to God. It's a faithfulness to Him. Just to let you know, the law has not even been given yet. No rules yet. That comes later as they're on their way then to Mount Sinai in the wilderness, in the Sinai. And that's where they get the rules. They obey the rules. They trust God. In a sense, they become even more dependent or at least linked to Him in their freedom because of what God does for them and what He did for them. They don't follow the rules, and because of that, they're set free. They follow the rules. They trust Him. They believe in Him because He set them free, because He rescued them. This is the difference in Christianity, or an understanding of who Christ is, and every other religion, every other self-help technique in the world. I'm not saying telling you that they're all bad or don't have their place of help, but there's a difference in them. For a lot of people, even in Christianity, as Christianity is practiced as a religion, it's not the same. Every other religion tries to build, every other program tries to build a bridge over the water, over your struggles and over your difficulty. Not Jesus. Jesus parts the waters. Jesus leads through on dry land, something nothing else can do. No other program, no other religion, not even Christianity as a religion can do this. Only Christ Himself can lead through on dry ground. From bondage, from slavery, from being, maybe sometimes a false sense of freedom to real freedom over on the other side, which is absolutely attached to knowing God, being in His family, being attached to Him, where you find your real satisfaction and your real sense of contentment in life, and where you find real freedom and real independence. They found it on the other side of the water. In Luke, there's this wonderful passage, I think it's in chapter number 9, where Jesus is standing there and Moses and Elijah have come back, and a few of the disciples get a chance to see him, and he's talking with them. And here's what's really amazing. As Jesus is talking with them, you can go look this up yourself. I think it's in Luke 9. He's talking with them, and it says they're discussing His coming departure. The word for Jesus' departure is they're talking about His death, on the cross and leaving. But the word for departure in the Greek is the word exodus. They're speaking of Jesus' coming exodus. Peter, 2 Peter, it's in chapter 1. Peter is talking about that, his time is not long for being here, that he's going to leave soon. And Peter discusses it, and he says, and talking about my coming departure, and you know what Peter uses? Same word, my coming exodus. It doesn't mean I'm not here anymore, I've lost the fight, death has won. He's talking the very opposite. He's talking about His final walk through on dry land. From slavery and bondage to absolute freedom in Christ. Because you see, even as a Christian, you haven't realized it all yet, right? You understand that. You still live in a broken world. Still live in a fallen world, a world that still struggles, a world that the further our culture walks away from God and tries to push God into a corner and eliminate God, loses more and more of its understanding of who it is and becomes confused with all sorts of identities about who we are because we've walked away from the Creator. We lose our sense of satisfaction, so we go after all kinds of things thinking it will satisfy us, and it doesn't fill us up. And we keep screaming and hollering and raising our fists for freedom, only find ourselves more and more and more in bondage to things because God himself has been moved from our life, and our rescuer, the only one who can walk us through on dry land to the other side to freedom, has been removed from our lives. Moses' call, God's call through Moses, call to us, call to you as parents for your children, lead them to freedom, real freedom, real identity, real satisfaction in Christ. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, we thank you. You've always been our rescuer, the only one who really understood what we struggled with and only one who really understood the answers that we were looking for. Because God, the truth is we get confused pretty quickly thinking this or that is going to fix us or set us free, only to find ourselves still in the same place, sometimes even worse than where we started. But Father, we thank you that you sent Jesus into this world so that we would have an exodus, a movement from one side to the other side, a place of real freedom because of Jesus Christ. If you're here this morning and you have never put your hope and your trust in what God has done, that he sent his son into this world. This is what it says in Hebrews 12. It says that Israel walked through the sea, but the Egyptians tried to do it and were destroyed because Israel had faith, they trusted him, and the Egyptians did not. And all those who put their hope and their trust in Jesus Christ are led to a place of true freedom. If you've never put your hope in him, never opened up your heart and said, listen, I haven't figured it out. I didn't do everything right, but I know I need a rescuer. I know I need a guide. I know I need a protector in life. And it's hard for me to trust, Lord. It's hard for me to believe. Honestly, fear still comes and hammers me so many times. But I want to believe you, trust you, and follow you. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.